You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert. There's a kind of pop health idea in circulation that moderate alcohol consumption can be good for your body. If you dig into it, you find out this is mostly the product of a very well-financed public relations effort by the alcohol industry that's somewhat at odds with the scientific consensus. And that raises a bigger question. Why is a substance that is well-established to be harmful to us as individuals in such widespread use through so much of human history? That is a question our next guest has tackled in a sweeping book that skips between different academic fields to try to stitch together a narrative of the role that alcohol has played in making it possible for humans to collaborate at the civilizational level. Edward Slingerland is a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia. His newest book is Drunk: How We Slipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to me how someone with a faculty line in philosophy whose background is in Chinese language and culture got started writing a treatise on the social functions of alcohol.
It's a little strange. Yeah, my colleagues would like an answer to that as well. My earlier work focused on this idea in early Chinese philosophy called wu wei, effortless action. So it's a state of spontaneity where it's kind of like being in the zone in a sport. So you're relaxed, you lose a sense of yourself as an agent. And when you can get into this state, you're very successful. You're creative, you can solve problems, you have charisma, people like you. So you want to get into this state, but they're faced with this tension of how you can try not to try. So my first trade book was called Try Not to Try. It's about this paradox, and it's a direct paradox. So when you're trying to be spontaneous, the part of your brain you're activating is actually the part you're trying to shut down. So there's a direct paradox there. And in that book, I walk people through the various kind of indirect ways the Chinese philosophers come up with to kind of get around this tension. But in one of these texts, the Taoist sage, the person who's in a state of wu wei, is compared to a drunken person. And it's clear that in the text, it's just meant as a metaphor. But it made me start to think about how chemical intoxicants, and especially alcohol, could be used by cultures and by religions as a tool to get around this cognitive paradox. So it's paradoxical to consciously try not to try. But if you could take a chemical substance that would reach into your brain and just turn the relevant part down a few notches, that might be a shortcut to spontaneity. And so that's what kind of set me off on this path of looking at alcohol as a technology.
If you compare alcohol to other recreational drugs in use, the physiological cost benefit comes out looking a lot worse. It's harder on your body than like cannabis or psychedelics or prescription drugs that some people take for pleasure. It's highly addictive compared to a lot of those substances. And it has some pretty well-documented social harms, like ties to violence, domestic abuse, things like that. Why do you think alcohol is the drug that becomes widespread so early in human civilization?
Yeah, it has these downsides relative to cannabis or psychedelics, but those also have downsides. So cannabis is highly variable in its cognitive effects, individual to individual. So some people, when I smoke cannabis, it makes me really paranoid and then super sleepy, and I go to sleep. So I'm really paranoid and then I fall asleep. So really great social drug for me. But other people, it makes really energetic and they want to talk about philosophy or go out and dance. Cannabis is hard to dose. So, you know, if you're inhaling it, you got to know how to hold it in your lungs. It's hard to know how much you're getting. Psychedelics are just hard to use in an everyday setting. They disconnect you from reality in such an extreme way that you're not going to gather with colleagues after work and drop LSD and then go home 2 hours later and have dinner, you know, take care of your kids. So these other drugs have problems, even though you're right, they are physiologically a lot better for us. And crucially, they're not physiologically addictive. What's special about alcohol, so it's just got, it's kind of at the sweet spot of all these different design specifications. So if you wanted a substance that was going to serve certain functions for human beings, and you asked an engineering team to come up with it, it would look a lot like alcohol. So it can be made out of anything. It can be made everywhere. It's easy to make. It's easy to discover accidentally because you come across a fruit that's fermenting. So you get the idea very easily. It has the same, very similar cognitive effects across individuals. It's really easy to dose. We know when you drink a pint of beer, you know exactly what you're getting. It has a short half-life in our body. So we have a dedicated machinery, because it is a poison, we have this dedicated machinery that breaks it down and gets it out of our body as quickly as possible. And so you can get the altered state that you want, and then an hour or two later, you're perfectly fine again. So it doesn't, the effects are fairly short. So there's a lot of good features in terms of its cognitive effects. But the fact that it's so incredibly costly physiologically is partly what motivated writing the book, is wondering why people use this substance. It's got to be about the positive effects, because the costs are so high.
And this is almost an evolutionary biology question. It's if it is so hard in our bodies, why have we not over time developed a distaste for it through selection pressure?
Exactly. And one possibility would be that evolution just hasn't figured that out yet. So the standard scientific story about our taste for alcohol that I try to debunk in the book is that it's a mistake. It's an evolutionary mistake. So alcohol just happens to activate some reward circuits in our brain. It's kind of parasitizing these reward circuits. And we're clever individual, you know, we're a clever species. We figure this out. And so we start using this to tickle that pleasure spot in our brain, even though it's not actually doing anything. We're kind of getting a reward for nothing. The problem with this is the costliness. But then you might say, well, maybe evolution is trying to fix the problem, but it just can't. It hasn't come up with the right mutation yet. And that's not the case. So there's actually a set of mutations, two separate mutations that interfere with the metabolism process of alcohol in your body. This cluster of mutations has appeared at least three times in human history. The one we know the most about is in East Asia, and probably evolved 7,000 to 10,000 years ago. So that's a really long time ago. And when you have this mutation, you don't like to drink, because you have one or two sips of alcohol and your face starts to turn red. You have heart palpitations. You feel nauseous. It's really, really unpleasant. And so why do people like to drink? The superficial answer is, well, because it makes us feel good. But the real question is, why does evolution allow it to make us feel good when it's so bad for us? And here we have a solution to the problem. If we all had that gene complex, we would stop drinking, and there'd be no alcohol use ever again. And yet this mutation arose 7,000 to 10,000 years ago in what's now Southeast China, and it hasn't really moved. It's gone a little bit to North China, a little bit to Japan and Korea, but it's pretty much stayed in place. And that suggests that there are selection pressures on the other side that's keeping the taste for alcohol in our gene pool.
So why don't you walk us through your hypothesis about what those selection pressures are. What is the case for booze being advantageous?
So we're a weird species. We're primates, and we biologically, and our basic motivational systems are primate based. They're very similar to our chimpanzee cousins, bonobos. But we live in these, especially in large scale societies, in these hyper cooperative situations that look more like social insects. I'm looking at downtown Vancouver right now, and it looks like a beehive or an ant colony more than anything else. So humans are primates that act like social insects. And it's a bit of an evolutionary puzzle how we pull that off. And there are probably a couple ways we do that. Religion is probably one of them. So my previous work focused on the role of religion in facilitating human cooperation. But alcohol helps too. So alcohol is doing a bunch of things for us. It is ramping up creativity. So we have a problem as adults as adults, we have fully developed prefrontal cortices. So the PFC is the part of the brain that's in charge of keeping you focused on task and allowing you to resist temptations and delay gratification and just, you know, be a good worker and kind of focus and get the job done. And that's a great quality. The problem is that interferes with creativity. When the PFC is in charge, we're very good at marching through a task step by step. We're very bad at seeing remote possibilities or making connections that might be unusual. And that latter task, what's sometimes called lateral thinking, is crucial for creativity. And that's crucial for innovation. And humans as a species are dependent on innovation in a way no other species is. Because we're helpless without tools, and we have to be constantly updating our tools. We're competing with other cultural groups that have their own tool sets, and if they do better than we do at using the environment, then we're in trouble. So there's a huge pressure on cultural groups to innovate, and alcohol is one way we help ourselves to do that. So essentially what alcohol does is turn down the prefrontal cortex a couple notches. It depresses the function of the PFC. And in terms of our creative powers, it returns us to being like a child again. So we can make connections. We're playful. We consider remote possibilities. So this is one crucial function is enhancing creativity. And this is why you see, you know, throughout history and across cultures, this association of alcohol with artists and poets and singers. There's a reason that this connection is made. It's because there's a direct effect on alcohol enhancing both individual and group creativity.
Let me follow up on that, because there are obviously a lot of tasks for which alcohol does not help. Driving.
Like, yeah.
Athletes are not getting drunk before they take to the field.
Yeah.
It's not, so far as I can tell, in widespread use among people trying to solve engineering problems.
Right.
So you're talking about kind of a sharply delimited form of creativity and performance.
I'm not sure that's true. So, I mean, your last thing point that's not used by people trying to solve engineering problems is not true. So it's, again, another incident that kind of made me start moving toward writing this book was, I was giving a talk at a Google campus, and, I was presenting this study that had just come out. This was 2012 or 2013, showing that if you got people to about 0.08 blood alcohol content, so about two drinks in, they're better at solving creativity tasks. They're better at solving this remote associate test, which involves kind of having a creative insight. And after the talk, and this was in the context of this early Chinese idea of spontaneity and creativity. And after the talk, someone shot up their arm and said, "Hey, have you ever heard of the Balmer Peak?" And I hadn't. And supposedly, it's probably apocryphal, but Steve Ballmer, supposedly the former CEO of Microsoft, discovered that his coding skill, so, you know, essentially his engineering skill, peaked at a certain blood alcohol content. And it was a very narrow range, and it got very bad after he passed the sweet spot. So supposedly he would keep himself hooked up to an IV of vodka to keep himself right at this blood alcohol content level, so he could code at this superhuman level for days at a time. And what I like about the story is this idea that, you know, the right amount of alcohol at the right time can be useful, even in very, you know, what you would think of as very cognitive tasks like coding software. And after telling me about the Balmer Peak, they took me on after the Q&A session, they took me on a tour of the campus. And the first place they took me was their whiskey room. So they have this awesome room that's just lined with single malt scotches and this beanbag chairs. And they said when they're coding and they run into a wall, they just can't figure out a problem. It's nothing's working. Instead of sitting in front of their computers and banging their heads against the wall, they stop and they go to the whiskey room and they pour themselves a glass of whiskey and they sit in the beanbag chairs and they just chat. And the combination of that relaxing of the prefrontal cortex and reduction of inhibitions, so maybe people are more willing to say something that they might otherwise not say because it sounds stupid or it's too speculative, that often helps them get past these problems. So it actually is useful in the right dose, even in very complex modern societies when you're trying to solve complex problems.
So then the second question this prompts is like, okay, you can make an evolutionary case that our circumstances demand a level of creativity that we only get by suppressing our prefrontal cortex. And since alcohol does that, evolution hasn't steered us away from using it. But it prompts the question, well, why hasn't evolution steered us towards a less rigidly constructed prefrontal cortex and just cut out the middleman?
Yeah, because evolution's stuck with it's an engineer that has different people yelling at it to do different things. So it has this tension where creativity is good, but being able to tie your shoes and get to work on time and not be constantly distracted is also good. So we need the prefrontal cortex. So essentially what evolution's done with humans is give us this really long developmental window when we don't have a PFC. So kids have very little developed PFC, and it's the last part of the brain to mature. It doesn't mature until your mid-20s. So this is why teenagers are so dangerous, because they've got almost everything else, but they don't have PFCs fully developed yet. And that allows us to do all this great stuff as kids. So we can be creative, we can learn. I mean, it's probably designed for being open and trusting and being able to uncritically absorb information, which is what you need to do as a child to acquire all the information from your culture that you need. So evolution's solution to these two different desiderata, and you're going to need different designs for those two things. And so its solution is to make the prefrontal cortex kick in really late in life. But even as adults, you know, it would be great if even as an adult, I could get back to that childlike creativity every once in a while. And so that's where tools like alcohol come in. It's basically a way to temporarily shut the PFC back down and get back to being like a kid again, but still being an adult and having all the knowledge and skills that you have as an adult. So kids, you know, Alison Gopnik is a developmental psychologist at Berkeley, and I rely heavily on her work when it comes to creativity. She's done the work showing that, you know, four-year-olds are great at solving these creativity tasks, and then there's a linear decline with age. And then once you become an adult, basically once your PFC is fully developed, you're not very good at these anymore. And she concludes at one point in her book on this, you know, so children are the R&D department and adults are marketing and sales or something like that. But what's wrong with that is that kids actually don't invent anything useful. Like, kids use their creativity for useless stuff. You know, they build these weird Lego things and they build castles in the sand. They don't solve coding problems. They don't develop new mRNA vaccines. So the beautiful thing about this temporary return to being childlike is you're an adult. You know what problems you're worried about. You know kind of what the space of possible solutions might be. And all you need is to get a nice little nudge where you just take the PFC, give the PFC a little vacation, take the playground monitor away for a little bit, and that can result in new solutions coming to you.
So that capacity for creative problem solving, that would become more valuable as we form larger and larger societies, because one person's breakthrough, even if it comes at the expense of their liver, can then be transmitted across a society or a civilization.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's ramping up individual creativity by downregulating the PFC. It's enhancing group creativity by enhancing sociality. And so this is one of the other functions of alcohol, is making us more social and more trusting and more cooperative. So we humans constantly face these cooperation problems that we can only get past if we trust one another. So we have to, you know, just trust that you're going to have my back, I'll have your back. And if we can do that, we can get a better payoff for both of us individually. So these dilemmas go by a lot of different names in economics, so the prisoner's dilemma, public goods games. But humans solve these all the time. And we solve them by trusting other people. And the way, one of the main ways we trust other people is by getting a read on them. So we look at facial expressions, tone of voice. We try to read emotions in their face to, you know, figure out if they're trustworthy, if they're nice, not nice. And there's going to be an arms race in that situation between individuals who are wanting to appear trusting, even if they're not, and us being able to detect who those people are and avoid them and not cooperate with them. And in that arms race, cultures have an interest in favoring the cheater detectors, essentially, in unmasking people who are not reliable cooperators. And that's where alcohol is also useful. So another effect of downregulating the PFC is it makes it harder for you to lie. So lying is a really cognitively demanding task. You've got to, you have to repress your knowledge of the truth. You have to keep in your working memory the lie that you're telling. You can't just read it off of reality. And what's that's a little more obvious, maybe. What people also don't realize is it's easier to detect lies when your PFC is downregulated. So when we're using our PFC and trying to detect lies, I think what's going on is we're, you know, we watched a detective show once where, you know, look at, see if they look to the left. That means they're lying. And so that's what we're looking for. And that's actually not what you're looking for. You're looking for some complex pattern that you can't consciously track. And so what alcohol does, or anything else that downregulates PFC, is it allows you to take in a broader bandwidth of information. And there's just, there's experimental evidence that people are better at detecting lies and liars when they're a little bit inebriated. It also, another cognitive effect of alcohol is that it's upping endorphins and serotonins. So it's making us feel better. It's making us feel better about ourselves. So we think we become more attractive and more witty and more clever when we're a little bit drunk. And we find other people to be more attractive and witty and clever when we're a little bit drunk. We like them more. And again, I review the experimental evidence that this is a real effect. When groups that are using alcohol as opposed to a placebo that looks and tastes like alcohol, like each other more, they're more spontaneous with one another, they report feeling bonded and having a group identity much more. And so alcohol's also served as this tool to bond people together, to get them to cooperate socially. And so if you combine those two effects, you've got a bunch of people who are individually more creative, and they're bonding, and they're disinhibited, so they're sharing ideas freely, and they're not worried about sounding dumb. That's what you need for cultural innovation. And I also review some evidence that when the ability to do that is taken away, innovation suffers. So there's a very clever study that done by this economist named Michael Andrews, who looks at prohibition. So prohibition, it's a nice natural experiment. So we think of prohibition as something that was imposed all at once at the federal level, but it was actually imposed at the county-wise over a long period of time. And what he does is look at counties that were wet, where drinking was legal, and then what happens when prohibition is imposed. And what he sees is patent applications go down by 15%, pretty significant drop, as soon as prohibition's imposed, and it takes years for it to bounce back. And he thinks what's happening there is you take away the saloon, you take away the venue where people can gather and drink a little bit and talk a little bit, and innovation suffers, and you can see it in proxies like patent applications. And I predict that we're going to see a very similar thing when we look back at this COVID period, where everyone's stuck on Zencastr and Zoom, and we're trying to, you know, come up with new ideas together, sitting alone, separated by thousands of miles. It just doesn't work very well.
So far, you're making the case that alcohol is kind of helpful, which would explain the initial question, why hasn't evolution steered us away from using it? But in the book, you also marshal some evidence in the field of archaeology that alcohol actually made it possible for humans to form larger social groups than hunter-gatherer bands in the first place. Do you want to walk us through that record?
In the same way that the standard scientific story about why we like alcohol is a mistake story, so we, you know, it just happens to trigger these reward networks, the story about why we have alcohol in the first place is also a mistake story. So, and this is what I learned initially when I was in school. We got agriculture because we were motivated by food shortages to start cultivating crops. And then sometime after we had agriculture, someone left some bread material sitting for too long. Their sourdough starter went old and started to ferment. And we drank the resulting liquid and we thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And we had beer.
We bakers call that liquid hooch.
Okay, there you go. Liquid hooch. So, you know, it's a byproduct of making bread in that story and a kind of accidental discovery. And that's what I always thought. When you look at the archaeological record, though, that doesn't make sense. So there's evidence now, and some of this is pretty recent, that humans, hunter-gatherers, were making beer, for instance. We have direct evidence of beer making from 13,000 years ago in present-day Israel. That's way before agriculture. We've got people gathering, hunter-gatherers again, pre-agriculture, gathering in these sites like Göbekli Tepe, so the site in Turkey, present-day Turkey, where they're coming together at this ritual site. They don't live there. There's no grain storage or food storage there. It's clearly just kind of, it's basically like a 12,000 years ago version of Burning Man. They show up, they erect these huge stone pillars and carve them with animal figures, and they're doing some kind of ritual, we don't know what. But they're also feasting. So we have massive piles of bones, they're eating animals, they're barbecuing, essentially. And then there are massive vats, liquid vats, that held some sort of liquid. And there we don't have the chemical residues. We don't know for sure that they were drinking beer, but I doubt they were drinking water. They were not drawn to this site to drink sparkling water. They were drawn by the promise of beer. We know beer was being made in the region and possibly hallucinogen-laced beer. So discoveries like these motivated this movement in archaeology that's called the beer before bread movement, that these people are arguing that what motivated hunter-gatherers to settle down in the first place, what motivated them to start doing agriculture, was not hunger. It was a desire to get drunk. They wanted to make more and better versions of beer. And so in that story, making bread is actually the byproduct. It's, you know, maybe the next morning they woke up and they were hungry, you know, had a hangover, and they're like, oh, maybe we can bake this stuff too. But it was the really first use was beer. And this is bolstered. You see the same pattern in other parts of the world. So in South America, the wild ancestor of maize, of corn, is called teosinte. And teosinte, it turns out, makes really terrible grain. So if you were looking for something to make tortillas with, you would not notice this plant. It doesn't make very good grain. What it does make is very good beer. It makes this beer called chicha, which is still made today in South America out of maize now. So it's in that case, it's got to be the case that people noticed this plant because they were looking for something to make a beer with, and this made good beer. And then they focused on getting it to be, you know, produce larger grains and be more reliable. And then it became good for making tortillas and other foodstuffs. But this is a pattern that's repeated around the world. The first domesticated species seem to draw our attention because of their ability to affect our minds, not fill our bellies.
So we've interviewed other people who look at the same archaeological evidence in Göbekli Tepe, and they say this isn't, you know, evidence that alcohol made civilization possible. They say it seems to be a religious gathering point, and it's evidence that religion drove the rise of civilization.
Yeah.
Or talking about a similar old site, Çatalhöyük, evidence that people kind of like got together to have parties and then civilization cropped up around them, but alcohol not necessarily at the center of that. So how do you separate the idea that people made alcohol as a byproduct of the first gatherings, from people got together for the first time to make alcohol, or because alcohol was there.
Yeah, it's tough to, you know, put one before the other, and it's revealing that the two almost always go together. So, you know, I work on the cognitive science, evolution of religion. That's one of my academic specialties. And so I know all the arguments about sites like these and how, you know, ritual is what causes us to come together and bond and be able to get beyond hunter-gatherer bands. And I've argued this in print, and I think there's a lot to it. What I came to feel was lacking in this literature is an adequate appreciation of the role of chemical intoxicants in that mix. And so in the cognitive science of ritual, for instance, people talk about synchrony, they talk about music, they talk about dance, they talk about kind of painfulness of doing it all night or doing it for several days in a row so you get into an ecstatic state. And these are all very important, and these have all been explored experimentally in the modern cognitive science of religion. What people, in my view, mysteriously fail to mention is that in most cultures that we know about, people who are doing these sorts of things are wasted. they're drinking huge quantities of alcohol, or they're taking hallucinogens, or they're doing both. And I think it's part of this kind of Puritan squeamishness we have about drugs or about pleasure. So you're absolutely right. You can't look at a site like Göbekli Tepe and say, people came there for the beer and they stayed for the dancing, right? We don't know. But it's significant that the beer and the dancing were almost certainly happening together. And all of this was happening before people had agriculture. And so I do think, you know, alcohol is one of the tools that we use to get us past the limits of hunter-gatherer level group sizes and form larger groups and then civilizations. Religion's definitely another technology that we've used, and I've been very involved in that line of research. But I think we need to appreciate that a big part of the religious complex is intoxicant use. Alcohol and other intoxicants are central to almost every religious tradition we know of. And so this was all happening in a synergistic way, I think, at these early sites.
I'm wondering if you could compare the kind of alcohol that we can reconstruct people were drinking in Göbekli Tepe with what we have available to us now.
It was like a near beer. It was weak. So it was probably 2-3% ABV. And that is, in fact, what people have been drinking for most of our history with alcohol. So this is another part of the book is about the dangers of alcohol, and in particular, the dangers of alcohol in the modern world. So there's been two developments relatively recently with regard to alcohol, distillation and isolation, that make it much more dangerous than it's been for the most of our history with it. So if our history with alcohol goes back, I'd say probably 20,000 years at least, we've been making alcohol. Relatively recently, we've started to really ramp up the alcohol content in these beverages we're drinking. And partly we've done that through better yeast. So we've been, you know, since we figured out how to ferment, we've been trying to get yeast to make higher and higher alcohol content beverages. And we can get it pretty high. So in, you know, beers get up, craft beers will get up to like 8% ABV now. And, you know, in Australia, where they push the grape to its absolute limit to make these crazy head-banging Syrahs, you can get up to 16, maybe even 17% ABV. But even in these beverages, alcohol comes with its own safety feature built in. There's a limit to natural fermentation. So the yeast are converting sugars into alcohol, and that alcohol is a poison. And they're producing it because they're more resistant to that poison than the bacteria are that they're trying to kill off so that they get the sugars. But they're not infinitely resistant to the alcohol. So at about 16, 17% is a limit, is the best yeast we have right now can get to about there before they shut down. And so this, in a way, is a safety feature. It means that the beverages we're drinking can't get more powerful than a certain level. But being clever species, we figured out a way around that, which is distillation. So in distillation, you're heating a beer or a wine, some mixture of water and ethanol, and the ethanol comes off first. It's more volatile than water. And then if you can capture that and collect it and then repeat this process several times, you can get something that's close to 100%. You can get in the 90s ABV. And so that's what distilled liquors are, is this an end run around the natural limits of fermentation. And that gives you a beverage that's just so wildly more powerful than what we used in our past that I arguably we're not genetically or culturally equipped to drink these beverages safely. Most of the beneficial effects of alcohol that I document in the book come at that sweet spot of about 0.08 BAC. And if you're drinking a beer, let's say you're drinking 3% ABV beer, even if you're drinking all night, you're going to stay about 0.08. You're not really going to go beyond that. If you're doing shots of tequila, you're going to immediately blow right past 0.08 and right into very dangerous territory if you're not careful. And so distilled liquors are not something we've historically had access to, and they're much more dangerous than naturally fermented beverages. So the stuff they were drinking at Göbekli Tepe was probably pretty mild, although again, it's possible they were lacing it with some mild hallucinogens.
So you talked about the other change being isolation. And one of the points you make in the chapter on this is that, in fact, distilled alcohol is an enabler of this. It's much easier to pick up like a life-threatening quantity of alcohol at the end of a rough day and take it home with you when you're getting distilled whiskey at the corner store than when you're dealing in 3% beer.
Yeah, no, it's so, the second problem of isolation is exacerbated by the distillation problem. Distillation makes alcohol much more portable, and it makes it actually cheaper because, you can make distilled liquors in huge batches and it preserves for a really long time. It's easy to ship. The other issue is that historically, we've always been drinking in ritual settings, like Göbekli Tepe. We've been drinking in settings where it's social, there's food involved, there's ritual regulations about how much you can drink and when you can drink. Almost every culture has some sort of toasting system. So there's a host of the party usually, and they decide when people get to drink. You can only drink when someone makes a toast. Or you can only drink when the big bowl of wine is passed around. So in the ancient Greek symposia, so these wine parties, essentially, the host was in charge of deciding when to pass around the wine, but also how much water to mix in with the wine. So the Greeks felt that it was dangerous to drink undiluted wine. So they would dilute it with water. And so the host could control. If things were getting out of hand, the host would water down the wine more. If things were dragging, maybe he'd make it a little bit stronger. You didn't just go up and grab as much wine as you wanted. You waited for the wine to come to you. So there's all these ways traditionally we've had of basically giving people a safety net. So, alcohol does hit these reward circuits in our brain. It's very addictive. Possibly up to 15% of the human population is prone to alcoholism and has trouble drinking safely. Historically, cultures kind of knew this and had tricks for limiting individual alcohol consumption and keeping it within safe levels. And that all gets thrown out the door when you live in, let's say, North America in the suburbs and you can go to a drive-through liquor store and they throw a case of vodka in the back of your truck and you drive it home and you have that in your house and you can drink it whenever you want without anyone watching. That's evolutionarily completely unprecedented. And it's a very recent development. And I think it's also very dangerous. And to connect it to current events, I think what COVID lockdowns have shown by exacerbating this trend of drinking alone and drinking at home is that it makes it really hard to drink safely. Problem drinking has gone up. Absolute levels of alcohol consumption have gone up. And it's because we've lost all the social cues and ritual regulations, both formal and informal, that normally help individuals. Individuals aren't good at controlling themselves when it comes to alcohol, so we need help. And social drinking is a way to provide help to individuals.
It kind of sounds like a reworked version of a hypothesis you discredited close to the start of this interview. The idea that alcohol was something pleasure that just kind of hijacked us as an accident. You're making the same argument about whiskey.
No, whiskey. So it's still serving the same functions, and whiskey in the right quantities can serve the same functions as can a Negroni, for instance, which is what I wrote. I had been working on various versions of the book proposal, and I think I was at version 10, and my agent was still not happy. And she was right. It was not, all the stuff was there. The science was there. The basic arguments were there, but it just wasn't popping. And I realized that I had not written any of it drunk. And that was the problem. And so I actually was on a business trip and I was meeting colleagues that evening, but I went down to the hotel bar with my laptop and had a Negroni, which is my cocktail of choice. And after Negroni one and about a sip into Negroni number two, what are now the first three pages of the book revealed themselves to me. The feeling was that I was taking dictation, not that I was writing it myself. And people loved the beginning of the book. It was actually a very good insight I had as a result of using distilled liquor. But I also was starting to get a beginning of a sense of how dangerous Negronis can be, how dangerous distilled liquor can be. So alcohol gives us pleasure. It's stimulating endorphins. It's stimulating serotonin production. That's one of the reasons it's the proximate, if you want to think in evolutionary terms, it's the proximate cause of us drinking. Why do we drink? The proximate reason is because it makes us feel good. But the deeper reason is because there are these functional benefits. And the trick is setting up your culture in such a way that you can capture those benefits while doing the most you can to mitigate the downsides. And there are a lot of potential downsides.
When we think about the risks posed by alcohol today, the concentrated, transportable, storable forms of alcohol that lend themselves to the unproductive forms of drinking you just laid out, I guess it kind of raises the question of whether modern society can come up with a better dimmer switch for the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, so I raise this possibility at the end of the book. You've mentioned there are other intoxicants that have advantages over alcohol. And one of those is class of substances we refer to as psychedelics. So, psilocybin, LSD, cause very little to no physiological harm. They don't appear to be physiologically addictive at all. So they have some benefits over alcohol. The problem, as I mentioned, is that they are just too powerful to use socially, to use in the ways we use alcohol. But one recent development, very recent development, is microdosing. So once we can extract the active ingredient from psilocybin mushrooms and put it in a pill form and precisely dose it, it's possible that we can figure out a dosing regimen that would give us very gentle alcohol-like effects without any of the downsides, without the addiction, without the liver damage and all these other problems. So I'm open to the possibility that the engineering team, cultural engineering team that had to come up with a solution and chose alcohol didn't have the technologies that we have now. It didn't have all the knowledge and the tools we have now. So it is possible that we could come up with a drug that does what alcohol does for us, but is safer. We just don't know yet because microdosing is such a new phenomenon. Most of the evidence about its effects is anecdotal. There's a lot of large scale studies, I think, in works right now, But I think it'll be another 5 or 10 years before we really have a good sense of what the long-term effects of microdosing are.
Well, it's nice to end a story on a to be continued. Edward Slingerland,
yes.
We'll leave you to whatever your future investigations are. Hope we have more data on microdosing in the years to come. Thanks very much for speaking to us about your book.
Thanks for having me.
Edward Slingerland is a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia. His newest book is Drunk: How We Slipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization.